Okay, everybody, welcome to the 4 o'clock panel, Biometric Identification, Sorting Fact from Fiction. This panel, as all panels here, are being recorded, so please wait for the microphone before shouting out. We're also collecting for the DragonCon official charity, the Atlanta Community Food Bank, so I'm just going to start by passing this around. We'll have our canned goods and toiletries can be dropped off at the Sheraton Hotel. I'll now pass you over to your panelists, who will introduce themselves.
Hey, my name is Jeff Termeshazen. I work for a payments company here. Prior to that, I worked for a company called Verint that did audio and video monitoring and analysis. I have a master's in cybersecurity, and I'm working about to start one for international studies and intelligence.
Oh, sorry, my name is Dave Moss. I'm an investigative researcher at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. I help file FOIAs and public records requests related to facial recognition and other stuff.
I'm John Padfield. I teach part-time for Purdue University, have a PhD in technology, leadership, and innovation, and do some consulting work on the side. I guess I'll start.
Yep. See if there's anyone else at the table.
When we first started talking about doing a panel on biometrics, three of us got together, shared a few ideas, and wanted to start off just talking about the evolution of access control. Biometrics are very commonly used for access, anything from getting into your cell phone to getting into very secure areas. But when we think about how access control has changed over the years, the first version of access control was really based on what you have. If I have a key to get into a lock, I have a key to get into a door. That evolved. We started granting access based on what I know. Do I have the right password? And now biometrics are bringing about the next step in the evolution of access control, and that is allowing access based on who you are. The idea of biometrics is not new. It's been around for a long time. The whole idea of granting access based on some physical characteristic, here's a really simple example. If you're taller than this, you don't get to ride the kiddie rides. Well, that is a very primitive form of biometrics. It's making a decision about access based on some physical characteristic, in this case, height. But when we talk about biometrics today, what we're really meaning, what we're really meaning is taking some measurement of a physical characteristic or a learned behavior. Physical characteristics, we're all familiar with fingerprints. Everybody has a unique set of fingerprints. And so if I have an unknown fingerprint, I can try and find who that fingerprint belongs to. Fingerprints, facial recognition, iris recognition in your eyes. There's many different types of biometrics that are based on physical characteristics. What some people don't realize is it's not just physical characteristics. Biometrics can also be applied to learned behavior. There's what's called keystroke dynamics, and this is as you are typing, the amount of time that it takes you to move from the letter T to the letter H when you're typing the word the, that is a learned behavior, but it is a pattern that everyone is a little bit unique on. Basically, you have a typing signature based on the speed going from one key to the next, and that is something that can be used for determining one person from another. Same thing with signature. That's where my background is at. When I was working on my master's degree, I did a lot of work with the Purdue biometrics lab and dynamic signature verification, not just looking at a signed signature, but watching a signature be signed on an electronic pad. There are some very consistent markers in that so that you can tell, is this person really who they claim to be?
I know with the typing speed, that's also being used for hacking, where they can actually tell what you're typing by how you're typing. Mm-hmm. It basically picks up the acoustics and determines from that. I think the best they got was like a 94 or 96% accuracy rate. So they essentially put a microphone on whatever you're typing on, they listen to what you're typing, how you're typing it, and from that they can get usernames, passwords, anything you're hitting as if they had a keylogger going.
So there's many different types of biometrics today. Signature verification, hand geometry is one that's been around. I've worked in buildings before where every morning to get in the door, I had to put in both a pin like you would do for a bank ATM, but then you also have to put your hand in. And what it's doing is comparing the shape of your hand, both from above and from the side, to make sure that your hand matches the hand that's registered to that particular pin. If somebody stole my pin number, just like stealing your ATM number, they could walk up to that machine, put in my pin number, but when they put their hand in there, if their hand didn't look exactly like my hand, they're not getting into the building. Just a couple of slides here before we move on. All biometrics, whether we're talking about facial recognition, signature recognition, hand geometry, they all work in a very common way. It starts with, I have a live image. This could be a photograph from a security camera. It could be a pressure pad when I'm signing something, but there's a live image, and I don't know for sure who this belongs to. That image then gets compared to a database. It could be a one-to-one record. If I'm claiming to be someone and you're wanting to verify my identity, it's a one-to-one match. Does this live image match what we have in the database? Or it could be a one-to-many. I don't know who this person is, but I'm going to take their photograph, compare it against my database, and see if I can find a match. Then the software determines, based on a mathematical formula, is this a match or not? So when we're talking about biometrics, there's two key terms. Verification is what your iPhone or other smartphone does when you put your thumb on the thumbprint scanner. Verification means I claim to be someone. When I have my iPhone, I'm the owner of that phone, I'm the user, I'm the one that has my fingerprint registered in that phone. So when I put my thumb down, the computer inside of that iPhone is not trying to figure out who I am, it's trying to find out, am I who this phone belongs to? So it's having to match a live image coming off of that sensor to an image stored in memory. It's asking, are you who you claim to be? And it's a one-to-one type of relationship. Identification is a whole lot harder. Identification is, I have an image, I don't know who this belongs to, and rather than checking it against one person to say, is this a match, I may be checking it against millions of records to see, is there any match? This will be something that police do when they recover a fingerprint from a crime scene. Don't know who it belongs to, but I'm going to compare it against millions of fingerprints, see if I can find a match. And I just want to show you what that looks like. Just going to use one example, not going to go through all the different technologies, but if I'm looking at a signature and I'm trying to figure out with software, is this signature really mine or did somebody forge my name? That's my first name. Software can very easily detect certain characteristics, such as what is the top pixel in this image. So I can very easily, with software, measure the distance from A to B, and I can measure the distance from A to C. If I look at the ratio of A to B divided by A to C, that's going to be fairly consistent. I don't sign my name exactly the same way every time I sign it, but that ratio is going to be pretty consistent. Well, I could also measure A to D versus A to C. I could also measure something like the ratio of A to C over E to F. If I'm signing my name someplace on a small line or I'm signing my name on a big line, the actual size of my signature could vary quite a bit. But these ratios are something that are going to be pretty consistent, whether I'm signing a check or signing my name on a small line. If I sign a bunch of things, the software can go in and say, here's the normal range. That ratio of A to B divided by A to C normally falls within this range. So that's one characteristic. When it's then looking at a live image, one of the things the software has to determine is, does this live image fall within a certain threshold? If not, that's probably not my signature. But if it goes through and it looks at several different ratios, height to width, the space above the line versus the space below the line, it can go through and say, does this meet all of these thresholds? If yes, that's probably my signature. If not, it's probably somebody forging my signature. And the same technology works with hand geometry identification. I use this type of machine every day for about a year and a half when I was working at Ingersoll Rand. Ingersoll Rand owns RSI, who makes the machine. But this was the machine that I mentioned that every morning going into work, I had to put my hand down on that scanner. I had to put in a code and then put my hand in. When I put the code in, I'm making a claim. This is, I am employee number such and such. The machine then knows what my hand should look like. What's the length of my index finger compared to the length of my middle finger? What's the width of each finger? one of the things I was just sharing with Dave before the presentation started, one day when I registered for this machine, when I first got hired, I was wearing my college class ring. That's the way my hand was in the system. The day that I forgot to put my ring on before I went to work, it wouldn't let me in because it was looking for that big lump on my ring finger. And so hand geometry, it's just one more technology that can be used, but all of these technologies work the same way. Here's my unknown image. I'm going to compare it against a database to see if I find a match, and then either allow or not allow access. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Dave to talk about the next aspect of biometrics.
Sure. Again, I work at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and last year the ACLU of San Diego and Imperial Counties in Southern California had contacted us because they had heard about this strange facial recognition program that San Diego is developing. In San Diego, there's a government agency called SANDAG. It's the San Diego Area Region of Governments, regional governments sort of thing. It's this massive non-elected body that does all sorts of policy for the entire county. And sure enough, they had received about $500,000 to start exploring mobile facial recognition. And what they had as of fall of last year is they would hand out 178 mobile devices. These were Samsung tablets and Android phones to police officers to go around testing out by taking pictures of people and then matching them up to mugshot databases. It's a lot easier for me to just steal SANDAG's presentation than come up with my own. But to give you an idea, so it's dealing with a database of 1 million booking photos and 93,000, well, 1 million from the San Diego and another 93 from Chula Vista, which is the second largest city in the county. I believe that they're trying to expand it, trying to figure out ways to make it compatible with the DMV records. That may take a while just because of compatibility issues. Let me give you an idea of what the interface looks like. Can you go to the next slide?
Yep.
Sweet. So the way it works is that you're in the field, you stop someone, you take a picture with your phone, it takes only a few seconds, and then you get like up to 10 possible responses. If you don't have one of these devices, you can take a picture with your phone and then email it to somebody else who does have one of these devices, and then they'll run it for you. You can also add photos to the database from the field. Can you do one more for me?
Sure.
And then, I got to look at my own sort of slide here. Sorry, which are we on? There we go. Like I said, it's up to 10, and they have 1 million images in the database, accounting for 313,000 people. 178 devices now. They've used it as of last fall 5,600 times. There are three different ways that they feel like they are authorized to take pictures of people. One is if they stop you and they get your consent. They stop you and say, hey, can we take your picture? And you say yes because you trust the police, or you say yes because you're scared of the police. Whatever reason you have consent. Another one is if they say you're lawfully detained, which could mean all sorts of things, from being arrested to just being under suspicion. And then the third, which is the most troubling, is when they take a picture, say, from Facebook or from a security cam, and then run it through the system that way, which isn't always as accurate, but it's still troubling that they can do that. One of the interesting things about this is that this whole thing is, the rationale is that this is, terrorism. They only give these out to officers who are designated as the terrorism liaison officers. But if you actually look at who's getting these devices, it's like the Del Mar Park Rangers has a device. Now, Del Mar is the ritzy North County beach neighborhood, and I can't imagine they're running into that many terrorists up there. Nevertheless, they have one. The Department of Insurance has one. Also, probably not running into terrorists that often. San Diego State University proportionally used it more than anyone else, like hundreds of times. It's hard for me to believe that there are that many, 200 plus terrorism suspects on San Diego State University's campus. So it's kind of this pretext of terrorism, but then they just use it for all sorts of things. We got a document through our Public Records Act request that had all of these anecdotes, because they didn't have any good statistical data to report back to say this is how effective it is. All they had were anecdotes, and obviously they're only using the good anecdotes. But even then, they were a little bit troubling. There were some ICE officers who were using it, and I shit you not, this is the story they put down in here, was, oh, we were investigating this suspected illegal immigrant. The guy next door seemed a little weird, so, and they actually used this term, our spidey sense was tingling. So they put him in the car and, asked him who he was, asked him if he had a criminal record, and he was like, no. And they were like, oh, yeah? And they turned around and snapped a picture of him, ran it through the database, and sure enough, he had like a drunk driving charge from a few years earlier. It's definitely troubling to me that they would be using this device instead of with probable cause, they were using it with spidey sense. But, that's law enforcement these days. So that's the sort of basics of it. We've also been doing work with the FBI's facial recognition database. By 2015, they expect to have 52 million images in there. Currently, they have 13.6 million, which is 7 to 8 million individual people, and 4.3 million of those images did not come from criminal mugshots. They were from other, obtained through a variety of other means. Yeah, that's my sort of introduction.
Well, I just want to throw one thing in there before we move on. A good friend of mine is a police chief up in Indiana, and we were having a discussion about body-worn cameras. It started off with a discussion about Google Glass, and he was saying, no, Google Glass is not going to catch on. That's not what law enforcement needs anyway. And he was describing the new beyond Google Glass that his department was testing out. And these were sunglasses that looked more like Ray-Ban type of sunglasses that had a tiny camera built into them. They weren't obviously camera glasses like Google. And he said, these are so incredible that the resolution of these cameras is awesome. We can get all of these images. We can wirelessly transmit them. This is fantastic for the department. And, we're having a friendly conversation. He said, what's so amazing about this is they're getting ready to merge the facial recognition technology with it. And he said, this is going to be so great for our officers when they walk up to give someone a ticket and the camera gets a look at the driver's face and it can automatically flash up in the, now this is not reality yet, but it's very, very soon. The glasses will be able to flash a message in the officer's sunglasses that this person's wanted. They have a warrant out for such and such. And that's just going to be awesome. And I said, what's going to happen the first time one of your officers is working undercover? He walks into a crack house and their glasses start flashing, undercover cop. Technology cuts both ways.
Yep.
Yeah. Two other sort of points that jumped into my head is, one is that the devices in San Diego, the next step that they, according to their PowerPoint presentations, is to install this on cameras on buses and in public buildings, which is a grave concern for us, especially with immigrant populations who use buses or need to go to the courthouse and maybe that has a chilling effect. The other thing is that they are going to try to expand this to cover tattoos. So beyond just face recognition, tattoo recognition.
Yeah, no, there's also been issues, I know here in Atlanta, with the traffic cameras getting pictures of people. I know there have been some cases where they sort of rolled it out before they were actually backing it up legislatively. So essentially, if you could get a free pass in court, if you just went in there and said, I'm basically contesting this, and they were like, okay, we'll dismiss the charges because we know we can't do anything with this at this point. But not quite as mobile as the camera, as the glasses and whatnot, but it's coming to the point that we are going to start having pictures taken of us in any public space. And currently it's legal. I mean, like, if you walk around Con here, unless they've got designated areas you can't take photos, which isn't a legal stop, is something, it's a hotel policy for that particular reason. But you, in the areas where you have no expectation of privacy, it's perfectly legal at this point for someone to take pictures. And because the police and other enforcement agencies can tap into that, there's absolutely no incentive for them to ever make that make it that there's nowhere that you can just have your picture taken. So anytime you see the cameras up, it's fast coming to the point that just assume someone's monitoring you. It's not really a question of if they're monitoring you. It's a question of what can they do with it once they have it. With your investigation there, did they ever do anything with the DEA?
I believe so.
All right. The reason I mention that is because we ran something similar with the NSA and the DEA, where there's a thing called parallel construction.
Actually, not the DEA, but yes.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So what this happens, and it sounds very much like what you were saying, the spidey senses tingling and whatnot. NSA would do a tap of something, get the information, see, all right, nothing to do with us, but it is a drug thing. So they pass the information off to the DEA and say, find a reason to be at such and such a place at such and such a time. Something's going to happen. And they break in fantastic busts on this. And that I could very easily see that happening there, where our mandate is we're doing traffic stops. But, hey, we saw this one guy walking out of the bar. We can't do anything about it. But find a reason to be here in like 5 minutes, and you'll catch whatever you're looking for. So the interconnectivity of these things is just skyrocketing. It's not a question of if it's going to happen. It's simply a question of when it's going to happen. Because like you were mentioning it popping up on the inside of the glasses, if they can wireless transmit, how many of you have been stopped by a cop who has not gone back to his car? Whenever they get your ID, they pretty much always go back to your car. If that thing's taking your picture, by the time he gets back to his car, your face is on his screen. And all he's got to do then is just check, all right, picture against what's already on the screen. So he's got to take a few more steps, but the warrants and stuff are already there. It's really becoming an issue of we have very little actual privacy, and the biometrics is just making it even easier. It is definitely a good thing when used responsibly to have all these biometric options, because I know I work in the payments industry, and our data center, which handles some probably Fortune 10 companies' data transactions, we have actually that model of hand scanner to access our data center because it's such a high-risk area. And there's about 3 layers of security you have to go through to get down to the point that they take your handprint. So in those cases, it's a really great thing because you can tell your customer with confidence your data is safe. Someone just can't walk in and, you know, plant a bug or something. But then the flip side is, and even when used responsibly, it's I like knowing that the cops can pick up bad guys before they do bad things. And not just the police, pretty much the government in general has a very bad track record of misusing that. And it's not even always maliciously misusing it. It's just being human. I mean, the TSA, when they're doing all the body scans, and it's like, the anecdotes would come out, yeah, we'd sit and save pictures off. You know, you get naked pictures of someone who's attractive. Yeah, we looked at them, we saved them, we shared them around, but nothing that was supposed to happen. None of that was malicious. It was still wrong. And police are going to do the same thing. They're going to, you know, hey, this is great technology. Let's see what our friend's wife's doing. Oh, dear, we found something we really shouldn't have told him. So if you guys are interested in this, and if you're interested in keeping that privacy, sign up with groups like the EFF. Find out who your senators are. Find out who your congresspeople are. Write to them whenever something like this comes up in Congress and tell them, fight against this for the following reasons. Because if we don't do it, the government sure isn't, because it's making their job easier.
Jeff, you said something interesting there. We are always seeing a lag for legislation when it comes to technology. You know, you have law enforcement agencies, which, you know, they're constantly being hit up by contractors who are like, "Ooh, look at this! You know, we have this great technology. You should use it. It'll result in, you know, all sorts of busts and warrant clear ups." And they just buy it. They get a grant from it. They, you know, figure out ways to obtain it, and they know there aren't regulations for it. They know that there's no limits put on it, and they just go for it anyways because they're making this calculation that if they have it, it'll be very hard for legislators to take it away from them.
Right.
Nobody, no policymaker wants to be seen as soft on crime or, you know, making it easier for criminals. So they grab it. You know, they just know no one's going to take it away from them. And we went with this facial recognition thing. We went and we listened to the minutes from these obscure hearings where, you know, the sheriff is like, "Hey, let me do a presentation on how awesome it is." You know, I think these slides came from one. Not a single member of this panel asked any questions about privacy. They asked nothing about civil liberties. That wasn't even a concern. They were just dazzled by how cool it was. And that's what you see, you know, whether that's facial recognition, automatic license plate readers, stingrays, any of that sort. People just don't ask questions about it.
I just want to build on that technology, and I don't care if you're talking about nuclear power, if you're talking about firearms or anything else, technology is neutral. I have never seen a good technology or a bad technology. It's all in the hands of the user. The work that I was doing a couple of years ago on dynamic signature verification, tremendous potential for that, because it's, I could take someone's signature and I could be very careful and I could trace their signature, or I could practice over and over and over again until I can sign someone else's name that looks just like their name because I practiced it. But what I was working on was called dynamic signature verification, and that's where the computer isn't taking a static image of a signature. It's watching the output of a pressure pad as you're signing. And my first letter of my first name is a J. The way that I make that arch for the J, it can calculate the acceleration of the pen as I'm sweeping up and as I'm sweeping back down. It's timing it microsecond by microsecond. How long does it take me to reverse directions when I complete the O in my name? There is no way on earth, I've worked in this, there is no way someone else can sign my name exactly the way that I do. You could sign it if you're real careful and go slow so that the end product looks like mine, but your timing is going to be way off. You will not sign it at the same speed that I sign it. And so dynamic signature verification, it is, I'm going to stop short of saying foolproof, but it is nearly foolproof that no one's going to forge my signature and be able to pass that level of scrutiny. It's a good, solid technology, but anytime new technologies are introduced, Dave's point about legislation lagging behind, that is absolutely true. I have a new blog article that just went up today on my blog, but here's the new technology. Smartwatches have been around for a couple of years. According to all the rumors, Apple will be announcing theirs on September 9th. And my question is it really smartwatches or smart cuffs? Because in my blog article, I linked to a few other articles about companies that are going out and they're buying Fitbit today. Fitbit is a little band, but it tracks your motion. You know, how many miles or how many steps did you take today? Did you walk or did you sit on the couch all evening? The largest... fastest growing segment for Fitbit's market is employers. I'm going to go out and buy 50 of these and require my employees to wear them 24/7 so I can make sure that they're getting enough exercise when they leave work. And if they don't, in the article, not my blog, but in the article that I cite, the employers are saying, well, we need this information so that we can reward participation in our wellness program and we can punish unhealthy behavior like going home and watching TV all night. Okay. I think you just crossed the line into turning these into handcuffs, because if my employer has the right to know what I do when I go home from work and it's his business now, if I sit on the couch one evening and watch TV and I didn't get in my 10,000 steps for the day, I've got a problem with that. So the technology, it's not a bad technology, and Apple has some really cool things that they're working on with their health book and things like that. I think it's great technology for individuals, but I shudder when I think about what insurance companies and employers are going to do with this data. There's a fundamental premise, and I'll come right back to your question, but there's a fundamental premise. Once I surrender data to anyone, I can't get it back. The internet has a long memory. So once I surrender that data to anyone, I can't get it back, and I have absolutely no control what somebody else does with my data. In the blog article, and I will give you the link to it later, but in the blog article, I talk about if you really wonder where this is capable of going, I'm not saying this is where it is going, but history does have a tendency to repeat. Go back to 1940, United States, 1940. There were Japanese Americans who did their patriotic duty and filled out their census forms in 1940. And about 1942, 1943, that information on those census forms were used for rounding up Japanese Americans so 110,000 of them could be moved to internment camps.
Yep.
The U.S. Census Bureau denied for decades. We had nothing to do with that. That wasn't us. Well, it was 2007 when the document surfaced that you've been lying to us for about 50 years. And it's beyond dispute. Census Bureau did participate in that. But information surrendered for one reason, even if it is a good, noble, honorable reason, once information is surrendered, you've lost all control over it. So what else can the information from smartwatches be used for? I'm not going to make predictions, but I know that there's potential for abuse.
I'd actually go one further. You said that they have the right to do it, and I would actually say if they get the ability to do it, you're pretty much hosed, because the right to do it just means that they can do it and get away with it. But I've seen a lot of job interviews and stuff where employers require employees to provide them with their Facebook login and credentials so the employer can make sure that they're not posting anything bad about the company to Facebook. And it's basically a requirement for getting hired. It's illegal, but it's a requirement for getting hired. And it's gone a lot more underground now once it sort of surfaced. Everyone's sort of going like, you can ask for that, but it is still out there. And again, they didn't have the right to do it, but they had the ability to do it. And a lot of people got cowed into providing that information because they wanted the job. And same thing with the bracelet there. Even if it is illegal, if they can get away with it, the legality will be dealt with later.
I think the first hand was right up here.
Yeah. Orange box to this guy.
Hang on.
What's that? Oh, easy enough, though, to end up having a simple armchair arm-mounted device that will jostle your arm sufficiently.
That's true. Those vibrating massage chairs at the salon would just throw those things all out of whack.
Getting slightly technical, but going back to the sandbag technology that you were talking about, did any of their data publish any information on false match and false non-match rates for any of it, or?
Not really. I mean, that, like I said, they did not really come back with any tangible data, like anything comprehensive. It was all anecdotal, which should be an alarm bell. Like that when you are picking and choosing your data that you're presenting back to, I think it was the Institute of Justice or something. Yeah, you're making that face, and that was exactly the face that we looked at when we saw it.
Well, I mean, technology, all biometrics is statistical probability, and to publish any sort of data on the effectiveness of a program without false match and false non-match rate is worthless.
Yeah,
but it depends who's doing it. If you're doing it like a scientific journal, yeah, everyone will throw it out. If it's coming in from a non-scientific source, most of the folk reading it will accept it because they're not expecting the level of science as far as citing and being able to do peer review and stuff like that. It should be at the same level, but you know, if I've got a, no one really expects the police department to write a science article when they really should be in stuff like this for the exact reasons you mentioned. But it's because it's coming from a police department, they're not looking for nearly the level of peer review ability in something than you would if EFF or a science foundation had actually published such a study.
No, but I think it's more than that. I think most people don't realize that biometrics is a statistical probability, that there is no yes-no answer in biometrics at all.
That's
in any
too.
Way, shape, or form. Uh-huh. It's a statistical probability score on whether or not they match. And to not have that kind of education out there is troubling in the sense that people are relying on it, assuming that it is a yes-no.
I'm going to look it up, just make sure I'm right in telling you that. We'll answer questions.
What happens, though, is you and I understand that this is statistical probability, and when I say that these two things match, we can actually put some confidence intervals around there. There's a, you know, 1 in 10,000 chance this is somebody else. But to the people that are out selling this technology to law enforcement, all they need is one good anecdote of a bad guy that was picked up before he did something, and that makes a good story that you can tell to the public, and around election time, we're keeping you safe because look at this and this incident, and don't pay any attention to those other 50 incidents we want to talk about.
Right.
Yeah, I just searched the final report for the word false, and it didn't, the word false positive did not come up, and the word accuracy did not come up either.
And actually, that's why this sort of panel is important, because it makes people aware that it is a statistical issue and that they should be asking questions. I know with DUIs, I don't remember who it was, but there's someone I think who spoke previously here who would challenge every he was a consultant, and he would challenge every DUI. That was his primary thing. On the basis of, had their monitor ever had a software upgrade, a hardware upgrade, anything along those lines, even if properly done, because it changed it from how it left the factory, and therefore you could not expect it to perform to the factory specs anymore, which make it invalid. So even though it was blowing absolutely perfect, he could say that this is not the same device that left the store, basically, and therefore these are invalid readings.
Sorry, you can point to
people. Oh, no, go ahead.
Question on this, what you guys were talking about with information about people sitting on the couches, you know, and companies being able to monitor that. I'm wondering if you perhaps know where Fitbit and companies like that store their information and how accessible it is, because I was reading an article the other day where a woman was basically trying to sue, I think it was Fitbit, because of not necessarily malicious use, but they were finding out when she was having sex because her heart rate went up every night at like 11 o'clock or different things like that. I mean, things that we don't commonly think of.
I am aware of Fitbit, but I don't have any information about where their data is stored or how anybody else would obtain access to it.
And again, that goes back to statistical probability. Target a few years ago sent out a packet of baby coupons to someone that their new store toy, this predictor, had calculated was pregnant. The problem was it went to a teenage girl who had not yet told her parents she was pregnant. So her parents called up Target and said, "What the hell are you guys sending my daughter stuff for babies for? Are you trying to get her pregnant?" And they're like, "No, she's already pregnant." Because they had worked out people who buy certain things in certain quantities at certain times are most likely pregnant, and therefore this is basically like a just a blind sell. It's like, we've got a good chance you're pregnant, we want you to come shop with us. And same thing there is that Fitbit, that'll all go back into statistics and go like, all right, we know people are having sex, this is their heart rate, this is, you know, the mean for their temperature and everything else. And you will start getting information like that coming out. There's another tech that is very new called SmartDust. I don't know if anyone's heard of that. And it's basically little microcomputers about dust size that have got different sensors in them. And same thing there. Each one doesn't have a whole bunch of sensors, usually one or two only. But again, because it's a dust, you can get it into something. It's almost impossible to get rid of it because it is so small. And it doesn't have a huge range as far as transmitting goes, but you can pick up all kinds of things from that stuff.
Something else that worries me a little bit is, well, this part doesn't worry me, but our deputy general counsel is here, and as part of our sort of cosplay activism we have going on, is he's wearing those Nekomimi ears. You guys familiar with these?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they have a little thing that attaches to your brain, and they can apparently read when you're focused or at relaxing state. But, I mean, Stanford researchers have been able to, I mean, it's a head-mounted chip, but have been able to determine whether you're thinking of a number or not, just based on readings of brain waves. And when that stuff becomes more mobile or, you know, you're able to read from a distance, then we're getting into a whole different level of biometrics.
Over here.
For those of us who want to use biometrics to make sure that stuff that we have only we can access, what technologies are legitimate? Because, I mean, we've all heard the criticism of the fingerprint readers and cell phones and that kind of stuff. So what are good biometrics for us to use to protect our information from somebody else getting access to it?
From everything that I have read, and I'm a Apple fan, I'll full disclosure, don't have any stock in them, but I like their products. From everything that I have read, they have done a pretty good job of quarantining the biometric sensor inside of the iPhone so that that information doesn't leave the phone. So to the best of my knowledge, that one is pretty secure. That's the only one I can really speak about. A lot of the technologies do store things outside of the device, and as soon as it goes outside the device, it's subject to being compromised. But from what I have read, iPhone 6 seems to be, or iPhone 5, and I'm sure they'll continue it in iPhone 6. That one seems to be a pretty tight sandbox that they keep that information in so that it doesn't get out into the wild.
You also need to do a lot of research because not everyone will be using the same level of product that Apple is. You know, they'll say, oh, we got fingerprint scanner too, but it's a much lower quality product with a much higher rate of failure. So it's not just that it's being used. You also need to find out sort of the tech behind it to see if the level of tech being employed in that particular device is at a sufficient level to make you warm and fuzzy. And then, of course, layer your biometrics. If you can do two or three different ones, you'll be that much more secure, because it's a lot easier to fake one item of biometric than to fake two or three that match up with the same person.
On that topic, but not to be make everyone in the room horribly paranoid, but I actually spoof biometrics for a living. Fingerprints are by far the easiest in the world to spoof. In terms of the electronic record that it stores, you're right, they're pretty well kept safe on a number of devices, but that is by far the easiest biometric to spoof out of all of them, because it's been around the longest. People have developed tons and tons of techniques. So as he was saying, if you're really concerned, you want to use multiples that are layered.
Right. I just wanted to mention that I was actually a victim of this of biometrics one time, and it was the facial recognition of all things. I'd gone with some friends to a rainbow gathering, if you guys know what that is. And so I found myself camping in western North Carolina, and the forest ranger came down, and he recognized me from that same issue. And you know, and it became a problem. You know, it wasn't a real problem, because I wasn't doing anything wrong. But at the same time, had I been, it would have been a problem. Mm-hmm. So,
PS, gentleman back there.
Yep. Which way?
Left and then right.
Okay. So, pretty much our civil liberties are eroding away, and we're in a huge transitional period to more and more technology. But we're seeing now large companies, pretty much any major tech company is either selling or giving all of our data away to the federal government. And since anything can and will be used us against us in a court of law, do we have any cases that have come up using biometrics to identify people as criminals?
I think there's probably a lot. I'm not one of the lawyers at EFF, but I think if they were here, they would be able to just rattle off a bunch. But I think it's fairly common now.
Yeah, especially with like no-fly lists and things like that, because I know when I was working with Verint, airlines were one of the places that they had cameras installed that they did do various types of analysis on. Some of it was face, some of it was just comparing a static image against what should be there versus what is not supposed to be there but now is. Like, someone walking through a corridor, it will do facial recognition, but then it'll also compare that if anyone's in this thing for more than, say, a minute, raise a flag, because it's not part of the static background. But yeah, I would probably see the most obvious one right now is your TSA no-fly lists and the airline security that are doing the facial recognitions therein.
And I'm sort of just looking at my notes here, but with the FBI's facial recognition database, they claim that the candidate list is an investigative lead, not an identification. So it's not something that fully determines that's who you are, but that gives them the pretext to keep doing other things.
Right. Oh.
Mm-hmm. I keep whacking my phone. My mic.
Yep.
It's obvious that this is happening at all the levels of government, but have you noticed that what level of government is it most effective to petition? Have grassroots organizations had more luck at local, town, county, state, federal? What level is most do you get the most efficiency in petitioning?
I would say a lot of that depends on how it's done. For example, here in Georgia, if you get a grassroots organization that goes out and collects a million signatures, submits it, that counts as one registration complaint, even though you've got a million signatures behind it. The same organization, or a different organization, you've got 10,000, but gets all 10,000 to essentially register a complaint individually, gets 10,000 points. So it's very much not just at what level is effective, but how is it being implemented at each level. Probably the most effective level will be the lobbyists. Either lobbyists or ex-members of Congress, because one of the perks they get as ex-members of Congress is, or the Senate, they get access to the congressional gym. And people get paid fortunes just because they have access to that gym, because that's where all the people go and hang out, and that's where you can chat with people. And but again, your lobbyists are extremely expensive, so it becomes a toss-up. Can you afford them, or are you going to go more for a mass push at a lower level that's a lot cheaper?
I think the folks on EFF's activism team would have various thoughts on this. For me, I feel like Congress has a hard enough time getting anything done that you should definitely influence them, but as far as actually having a piece of legislation pass, it may be more difficult. I've heard anecdotally that, say, with the California legislature, it only takes like 5 phone calls to get your legislator to move something up to a priority. But I also think, you know, at the very basic low level, had there been one person in that SANDAG hearing who had said, I'm a member of the public, I care about this, that may have been enough for them to send the Sheriff's Department or SANDAG back to come back with an evaluation of the privacy implications. And then from there, if that person comes back again or hands it over to the ACLU, then maybe, you know, they do write a very, very strict privacy policy, or maybe they just junk it altogether because there's somebody bringing up questions. I don't think you can overestimate or the impact on your local government, because a lot of these hearings, there's no one from the public there. And if you just go, that makes them, you know, that changes the entire dynamic and the perception of who's paying attention. Or get a reporter to show up, because that also changes the dynamic.
Yep.
Yeah, you with the ring there, let's say you got bit by a bee on the way in, it swelled up, you couldn't get to work. So my question is, what was your next level that you had to go through in order to get into work? Because you couldn't get in without the ring on.
You're absolutely right.
Right.
If something had happened, if I had consumed a lot of salt the night before and my hands were swollen, the machine's not going to let me in. And in that case, what I had to do is pull my cell phone out and call the secretary who was inside the building and ask her to come let me in.
I say, so somebody recognizes you, hopefully.
But from an automated standpoint, I could not get in.
You force them to let you in. I'm just saying, right? The level there, you know, that next level down has to be just as secure.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
What was your guys' policy there in tailgating?
The strictly worded policy was absolutely no tailgating. For those of you not familiar with it, tailgating is I have opened the door either with a pass key or my hand or something like that. I've opened the door. Dave comes along right behind me, and I've worked with Dave for the last 2 years. I know who he is, and I let him follow me in. What I might not realize is he got fired last night. And so there's a very strict policy. You're not allowed to let somebody tailgate and come in behind you. The door is supposed to close between every employee, and everyone's supposed to clock in. Realistically, I live in the Midwest. People in the Midwest generally trust each other, especially someone I've worked with for 2 years. And so tailgating happened all the time, but it was against policy. Back to your point, biometrics, it's a technology that has a place, but it's not foolproof.
He's got his hand up, green shirt.
I'm sorry, when you were talking about the SANDAG meetings, did you say that they were open public or closed door hearings?
They were open. There just was no one there.
Okay. Well, here's my question, because I know with the government, they are going to have a lot of closed meetings. And to try to keep abreast of what's going on, and say if you want to become active and make sure that stuff like this is going on, you actually have a public voice. I mean, are there channels that you can listen through or people you can talk to try to keep abreast of, say, we're going to go ahead and do closed door and it's going to have a major like policy change? So you can at least try to be aware of what's going on. I mean, is there ways to do it, or are you just going to be out in the dark on it?
Well, it varies state by state. I think in California, for example, there are very, very strong open meetings. You know, they can have certain deliberations in closed meeting if it relates to litigation or, you know, various very highly sensitive things. But generally speaking, you know, it's hard for bodies to meet in closed doors just because the law says they can't. The easier thing is just to make it very hard to find the announcements of meetings. And so you kind of have to go, you know, look online, you know, keep checking back, subscribe where it's possible, to subscribe to a mailing list. There are various services that are popping up where you know local open government person will create an alert for whatever obscure, you know, you can sign up and say, I want to track. God, it's like the fourth time. Who can track, you know, say you want to track, you know, the public safety committing for Sandag. You know, they can set it up so anytime it's updated, you'll get an alert for it. I think there's a few sites like that online. But really, it's just, you know, due diligence as a citizen. So
I think pretty much every place, they do have rules about having to publish meetings X amount of days or weeks before they have them. So your real trick is finding out where those notices go out, as you were saying. And that could take some legwork because you can try your, you know, local mayor's office, local city councils, local municipalities, anything along those lines. Find out where they publish and what their particular rules are regarding that. Because some may give a week, some may give 5 weeks notice.
Yeah. Or just file Public Records Act requests. Where do you live?
Right now, I actually just moved to Georgia.
Georgia. Pittsburgh. I don't know what the title of Georgia's Public Records Act is, but you know, just going down a list and, you know, filing with your local police department or sheriff's office, I want everything you got on facial recognition. I want everything you got on drones. I want everything you have on automatic license plate readers. And just see what you get, because, you know, not only do you get the information, does that help you, but it's kind of like shooting a, you know, across their bow saying, hey, somebody's watching.
Just one thing on that, and not to say what he's saying is a bad thing, but be aware that if you do things like that, you can also put yourself onto their radar. Even though what you're doing is perfectly legal and legitimate and you've got absolutely no bad background, if you've got a bad police department, they can cause trouble for you. And that's something that, unfortunately, you should be basically aware that it may happen. If anything, though, it should actually encourage you to do more of that kind of thing. But just be aware that it can happen.
But if you put in a Public Records Act request for facial recognition technology and then they hassle you, give me a call.
I can throw this in because I don't work for EFF. I've been a financial supporter for a couple of years. But when you think about the organizations that are influencing the government, you've got a lot of vendors and contractors out there who are making money off of selling this technology. They have big dollars at stake on selling this technology. When I think about any one of us sitting in this room, how much money do we stand to make on protecting our privacy? Nothing. We just want to be left alone. And so we don't have the lobbying voice that some of these companies do. EFF, that is the best organization I know of as far as a voice that tries to shine a spotlight into places that needs a spotlight shown on them.
I was just more curious where you saw the future of merging biometrics with those RFID chips.
Very good question. We have practically done it to ourselves already with cell phone technology. I was here last year as a audience member during a presentation about cell phones and just what can be done with and without a warrant. And I'm not worried about, personally, I'm not worried about the RFID or any type of chip-based tracking. We do that voluntarily with the cell phones that we carry around, and that information is flowing through companies like Verizon, AT&T, and either through direct cooperation because they have financial incentives or through other channels. That information coming out of our pockets every moment of every day, that's winding up in databases that I'm not real happy about.
I do think it's interesting to look at how all this technology is combining. They don't just exist in their little compartments, but they are looking for combinations. And one of the most interesting things about Sandex facial recognition program is that the company that's selling it to them is called Face First. But that's their doing business as name. Their actual name is Airborne Biometrics. So if you start seeing facial recognition on drones, now you know why.
Also, in your RFID, I ran across this actually on Wednesday. You can buy a RFID cloning kit for about $20 online. Okay. RFID cloning kit, like RFID, to make a clone of that, you can get them online for about $20. And if you can download the plans for free, but they'll actually sell you a kit for about $20 online. RFID cloning, like your proximity badges.
To that point, you can also get an aluminum wallet for $20 that RFID can't penetrate, just FYI.
I mean, people are mindful of microchipping their animals at this point.
They microchip their kids too. And actually, like saying with a Fitbit, you're microchipping yourself.
I didn't have that much education in biometrics, but one of the things I heard about in that class was that they measure your gait or how you walk, and that is also a very, was supposed to be a very secure method of making sure that it's the right person that you're identifying. I don't know if that's something that you know anything about, or if that's archaic or outdated.
Yes, that technology does exist, and all of us have it to a degree. If you live in a house with several other people and you hear someone walking down the hallway, you can probably very quickly figure out if that's one of your kids, your spouse. You can recognize that gait. Well, if you can recognize it, a computer can be taught to recognize it. Now, it's kind of like going back to the hand geometry. It's not necessarily unique enough that I can hear somebody walking and figure out who they are. But if it's somebody that comes in frequently, I know your gait sounds like this. And so if you come walking up to a keypad and put in a code, but the microphone in the hallway says that doesn't sound like you, then you could be denied access based on that.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny because Sandag also has that, but it's in their other division for transportation where it's coming in under the auspices that they're using it to detect where pedestrians are and detect where bicycles are. But I mean, this is the same agency that also controls technology for law enforcement, so it's not that big of a leap.
I read something last night, which I think will become something big in this field, is that they have figured out that if people live in close enough proximity, you actually leave a bacterial fingerprint around your house. And if someone's removed from the house for a few weeks, it drops off and it assumes a new standard. And they've actually, it's not there yet, but they say that it looks like it's going to be to the point that they'll be able to identify off of that who's been where, when, within certain time frames. But so your biometric may not even be something on you anymore. It could be just your bacterial fingerprint you leave behind from where you live.
Okay, we have time for one last question.
Okay, right here.
All right, you guys are talking about emerging technologies. So how about, say, a century from now when, let's say that all of this is mature and the government, if they want to, can completely tell where you are and what you're doing. What guidelines would you guys like to see to not do improper stuff, just not access it in a way that you think that they shouldn't access? What should be the rules?
Don't let them get to that point. That's pretty much the only thing.
Did you say a century out?
Sure, why not?
Man, I don't even want to predict 3 years out. I think just in general, though, the principle that you don't collect things on everyone is that if you're going to collect things, collect it on people where you have some suspicion and it's targeted. That just the general rule is that we shouldn't be collecting evidence on every person in a population.
And spidey senses don't count as targeted.
Spidey sense is not probable cause.
I want to wrap up with letting you know about something. My daughter is at the back of the room, and she has cards like this. If you are interested in a copy of this presentation, get one of these cards from her. There's a web address and an access code. There's no charge. You can go out and do that. If you are interested, the blog article about the smart cuffs, you can get to that through the same website. There's a blog out there that has articles that may be of interest to you, but just see my daughter back here at the back and get a card that has the access code for downloading the presentation if you're interested in that.
Is that it?
That's it. Thanks for coming, everyone.